Good afternoon. I'm Richard Keller, Professor of Medical History and Bioethics and Associate Dean of the International Division. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to the 15th Job Sofa and Margaret Jackman Sofa Lecture. I'm delighted to welcome the Sofa family to our campus and to express our gratitude to Mrs. Sofa for her generosity and thoughtfulness. This lecture series has become a proud and distinguished tradition made possible by her gift. Mrs. Sofa earned her bachelor's degree at the University of Wisconsin in 1946, and her late husband, J. Job Sofa, was a 1947 graduate of the Wisconsin School of Business. More than a decade ago, Mrs. Sofa came forward with a simple but powerful idea to bring distinguished women from around the world to our campus to talk about contemporary issues of global significance, and especially women's and children's rights and world peace. The International Division has had the privilege of helping her fulfill this vision by hosting human rights activists and leaders from around the world here on campus. Just last year, Chancellor Blank acknowledged the impact of Mrs. Sofa's vision in a letter of conveying our best wishes on the occasion of her 90th birthday. I would like to quote from that letter. "Your gift has enlightened a new generation and has touched many lives with the stories these speakers have shared. It is alumni like you who really exemplify the Wisconsin idea, making our university a leader in standing and inspiring us to apply ourselves to making the world a better place." We're joined by a partner in hosting this event, the University of Wisconsin Law School Human Rights Program, a multidisciplinary initiative that seeks to foster dialogue and collaboration on human rights research, teaching, and engagement across campus. Please join me in welcoming Professor Alexandra Huneas, Chair of the Human Rights Program Steering Committee and a leading authority on human rights law, who will introduce our speaker.
Good evening. I would like to begin by thanking a few people. I would like to thank, first of all, of course, the Sofa family, again, for their generosity and thoughtfulness in giving this gift to the university. I'd like to thank Dean Podesta for inviting the Human Rights Program to collaborate with the International Division on organizing and working towards putting this event together. It's our second year doing so, and it's a great opportunity for us. I'd like to thank our student group. We have a new human rights student group that has also been collaborating with us and putting up signs around campus and helping us with this event. And any of you students here who are interested in joining, you need to speak with Lamine, who is standing. Can you raise your hand? In the back of the room at the end of this lecture and sign up, and he can tell you about that program. I'd also like to thank Steve Stern and Heinz Klue, who were the PIs, the principal investigators on the grant that initially funded the Human Rights Program and recreated this presence on campus. And I would very much like to thank Sumudu Atapatu, the associate director of the Human Rights Program, whose work has been crucial, her leadership and her hard work in putting together this program, as well as the other events and activities of the Human Rights Program. Now I'd like to turn at last to introducing our speaker, Renana Jabwala, who is a renowned social worker and the author of many books, and she's focused her life's work on helping the poor and the marginalized empower themselves. She was born in New Delhi to a family of also very renowned people. Her mother is a novelist who's won the Booker Prize, her father an architect, and she herself had the opportunity to study not only at University of Delhi, but early on in her life came to the United States and studied at Harvard University, focusing on majoring in math, and then moving on to graduate studies at Yale. So she's clearly someone who had a lot of choices in life about what she would do with her life, and a lot of opportunity and a lot of talent. But she chose, and she earlier came to my human rights class today, and she explained to us that it was in looking at the contrast and between the United States and India and the poverty that she saw in India when she returned there that she decided to devote her life's work to working with women, especially women in the informal sector, some of the poorest and most marginalized people in India. She began her work in the early 70s in the Self-Employed Workers Association, SEWA, where she works to this day, and she's helped grow that from being a one-city organization to expanding throughout India. And the work that they do is they organize women who are in the informal sector, women like garment workers, women who make incense sticks or who roll cigarettes or weavers or domestic employees. She helps them organize to access some of the rights which so many of us take for granted, rights like the right to health or right to housing, right to compensation and welfare and social security, pensions. So she's truly someone who's an exemplar of someone who has devoted their lives to working with the poor and the marginalized, not only in her region, but throughout India and really throughout the world, as she, through her advocacy and through her books, reaches out to ever larger audiences, including us today. So it really is, we're very honored and inspired to have you here with us today, Runanna Jabala. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you so much for this very warm welcome. And thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak to people in the University of Wisconsin, very beautiful university as I've seen so far. And I especially want to thank you because I often feel it's not really me speaking, but I come from Seva, as you said, and I'll explain what Seva is. And I feel that, and I know that the women who are our members, they don't really have a voice. They're in a way invisible. They don't appear in the newspapers. They're not in the television. And so they need a voice. And these are the small opportunities they get to say what they need, who they are. And so I thank you for that opportunity. I'll just tell you what SEWA is. SEWA stands for Self-Employed Women's Association. And today it is a family of organizations. We think of ourselves as a movement. But we started 40 years ago, and I joined when SEWA was very small, 5 years after it was made. And it started actually in the city of Ahmedabad in Gujarat, which is in the west of India. And it started as part of a large trade union called the Textile Labor Association. Ahmedabad was a textile city, and the textile mills had become formal, what's called the formal sector, proper employee-employee relationship, good social security. And as it formalized, the women in the textile mills were kind of moved out and had to go into jobs like vending in the streets, picking up rags, doing things in their homes, being domestic workers. And they began coming to the Textile Labor Association saying, you know, why can't we have our union? Why can't we be part of you? And a woman in the Textile Labor Association, who's our founder, whose name is Ila Bhatt, she had a meeting with them and said, yes, why can't we form our own union? And the women said they were willing to pay membership fees, and they took out their membership fees. And in 1972, a new union was born. Now, these were women who were doing many different types of things. So, you know, what to name it? You can't call it textiles. You can't call it street vending. So it was named in Gujarati. I'll say the Gujarati words and then explain what it means, as Swashri Mahila Seva Sangh. And Swashri actually means by her own labor. So, or by her own work, not even labor, by her own work. And Swashri, by women working by her own work and coming together. That's sort of what the name means. And we translated it into English as Self-Employed Women's Association because Seva in Indian languages means to help others. So it was formed then. That time when I joined, it had all of 900 members. It's expanded. Today it has 1.8 million members, all over India. And when I say member, it's a person, a woman, who gives a membership fee. Our members, I think Alex already explained, are women from the informal economy, those who don't have a proper employer-employee relationship, especially those who don't have social security. And they are not marginal in the sense that most people, women and men who work in India, more women are in this sector, most people are actually in the informal sector, what is now called the informal economy. And I just have some figures to read to you because we started in India. That time we didn't think about, you know, what to call them other than self-employed. But as we developed and as we made contact both nationally and internationally, we discovered that the informal economy is very widespread. In India, we came to discover many years later that if you actually look at the statistics on the informal economy, in India, including agriculture, it's more than 90% of people work in the informal economy. Professionals are in the formal economy, people with proper jobs are in the formal economy, but more than 90%. If you exclude agriculture, which is all informal, and now I'll read you the figures. These figures, by the way, didn't exist. It is only after decades of working, we formed an international network called WIGO, Women in Informal Employment, Globalizing and Organizing, which consists of researchers and activists and policymakers, that we've got these figures, and this is them. So in South Asia, and this is non-agricultural employment, not including agriculture. In South Asia, 82% of the workforce is in the informal economy. The lowest is in Sri Lanka, which is 62%, and India is very high, 84%. In Southeast Asia, it is 65%. In China, about 40%, but nobody really knows about Chinese statistics. In Latin America, it is 51%. In sub-Saharan Africa, it is 66%, and it's brought down because South Africa has 33%, whereas a country like Mali is 82%. And in all these countries, and these are the developing country statistics, I actually didn't bring, there are similar statistics for the OECD and the US and Canada. But they're not called informal. They're called non-standard work, part-time work. And that's also quite high. But in the developing countries, of all these workers, about 50% are self-employed. I just wanted to tell you these figures, partly because we've spent a lot of time trying to take them out, but also partly to show you that this is not a marginal part of the economy. This is the major part of the economy. And yet, when the economy of India or any developing country is projected, there's very little said about this huge informal sector, informal economy. Let me go back to Seva. So at that time when we started, we didn't know all this. We had 900 members. And what we heard to us when we started, what we heard was that they really had very low income, insecure work, were treated miserably, and they had no economic rights. And since we came out of a trade union, we formed a trade union, and we formed a trade union for their economic rights. But we soon discovered that we had to be very different from a normal trade union because they had no one employer. Who do you bargain with? Even if there was an employer, it would be many contractors, like, for example, in rural areas. Big farmers employ agriculture workers, but then they employ a group for 10 days here, another farmer for another 15 days, and so on. So, you know, who's the employer, one employer? Many were self-employed, so, you know, who has to give them the economic rights? With whom do they bargain? Who is exploiting them? And it turns out that there are many different actors against whom or with whom they have to bargain. I actually could tell you of many, many types of work, but I'm going to talk mainly about the first members that came to SEVA and who are still members of SEVA. And in a way, the problems have not changed over the years. And those are women, and of course, they are also men, who are street vendors. That is, people who sell fruits, vegetables, old clothes, electronic items on the streets. And they sell them through a basket. They carry basket, or they have a cart. When I first joined, I met this woman. Her name was Raji Ben. She was very young at that time. And she was a vegetable vendor in a market called Manik Chowk. And in that market, there were a lot of women and there were also men, and they would buy fresh fruit and fresh vegetables early in the morning, like 4 o'clock. She'd get up at 4 o'clock, she'd do all her household work, make tea, and then go to the market, buy vegetables, come back, sell it till 10 o'clock, go home, cook for the family, come back at 4 o'clock, and sell up to 9 o'clock at night. And I met her because she came crying into our office saying that the police have upset my, she had a cart. She said they have upset my cart and they are going to arrest me. And this happened very often. And then me and some other people, we went down to the police station. We said, you know, what is happening? And they said, no, these are illegal encroachers, and they are disturbing the pedestrians and traffic, and they must all be removed. So we then got a lawyer. We got her released. She did get arrested. We got her released. And then we went further into the issue, and what we found, what Raji Ben said to us, was that how can I be an encroacher? Because she had been sitting there. She was young. She was 25. She had been sitting there with her mother for the last 10 years. Her mother had been selling on the same spot for 25 years before that. And what she said, what the mother said, was that, you know, two generations ago, the city elders had brought us here from the villages because there was nobody to sell fresh vegetables. And now that was an open space, and then shops were built and roads were built and more cars came. And so now they were the encroachers and they were being asked to be moved. And this was in the city in many places. And so we brought people together, many of them became members. We went to the municipality. We said, you know, they have been there for a long time. You should allow them, give them space, give them licenses. And the city refused. They said, we will not give them licenses. And we then realized that the only strength they had was their numbers coming together, being able to come together. And so all the street vendors in the city, as many as became members of ours, came together. We had a demonstration. We called the chief minister, and he came because there were large numbers. And the first thing he said was, well, why are you in the city? Why don't you go back to your villages? But anyway, he was positive. And then he said that, well, why don't we map out the area, give them each a space? And then so for about 4 or 5 years, that went on. And then, of course, there was a new chief minister and a new police commissioner, and the whole cycle started over again. So the thing is that it's not just the law. I mean, it wasn't just the police and the municipality. It was a whole mindset about, should Raji Ben be sitting there on the pavement selling vegetables? A lot of people who had cars said, no, that should become car parking space because we come in, we want to go to the shop, so we don't have space to park. And Raji Ben's argument was, well, I've been sitting here through generations. I'm providing a good service. I'm giving you fresh vegetables. I'm making my own employment. I'm not dependent on anybody. So then we went to the court, and we fought many cases in the court. And we are very happy that at some point the Supreme Court gave a judgment that street vending under the fundamental right to trade in our constitution, street vending is a fundamental right. But it's not just that you could just sit anywhere and sell. You had to look at the rights of the pedestrians and the traffic, and therefore the city should plan. And so we got some relief, but it wasn't enough. And now, 40 years later, we are still struggling because as urban space intensifies, as urban land prices go up, there's a huge competition for urban space. And as I said, we have only two weapons in a way. One is political, coming together. There are about 10 million street vendors all over the country. And if they can be more organized, then they have a voice. And the courts, who have been fairly positive from time to time. We also, last year, organized and got a new law which orders cities to plan for street vendors in their own city. So let's see. What we found, so this was just the street vendors, and this, I've told you, a struggle of 40 years. And meanwhile, we were organizing other trades, women farmers, women agriculture workers, construction workers. But what we found was the struggle for rights was really not enough. It's necessary. It's necessary to bring people together, and it's even more necessary for women, because women are taught to feel that their words, their work is not of value. And so in order to value, when they come together and they talk to other women and they talk to officers, and they suddenly see themselves in a different light. So coming together, organizing rights is very important, but it's not enough. And going back to our street vendors, I told you that Rajiben would go to the wholesale market in the morning at 4 o'clock and buy vegetables. Often she wouldn't have the money to buy the vegetables, so she would have to borrow. The borrowing rate then and today is an interest rate of 5 to 10% per month. What is that? That is 60 to 120% per year. So the income of the people who are borrowing, you know, all went in interest. And this was just for business. But if there was a medical emergency, if there was a marriage, which people spent too much on, then again they would go to the money lender, again get the money, and again, you know, sort of be in this downward cycle of debt. So when the street vendors talked to us, at some point they said, well, why can't we get loans at lower interest rates? And so we tried to connect them with the banks, and the banks didn't want them at all. They said, no, we don't like these women. And there's a lot of prejudice. You know, they're dirty, they're lower caste, they don't know how to speak, they're uneducated, they come with their children cry, and so on. So so then the women, we had a big meeting. We said, what shall we do? And the women said, we may be poor, but we are so many. So if we all put a little bit, then we can have our own bank. And that was a very novel idea, but they did it. They all put little bits, which became the shares, capital of the bank. They started savings, and we started as a group and then converted it into a bank. And we now have a bank. This was 35 years ago, long before the microfinance and microcredit discussions had begun. So we had our own bank. It's now more than 30 years. And it's a place for women to save. You know, they don't have any place. They want to save for future. They have no place to put the money. They hide it. They put it under the bed. But they want a safe place to save. They take loans. We have very good repayment rate. But we have gone even beyond that because often there's an accident or there's an illness. And, you know, they're not able to manage. Again, they go back to the money lender. So for crises, we've started an insurance scheme, an insurance cooperative, in fact. And then since it's been so many years, many of our members have become ill. They become old. They become older and older, and they cannot stop working, though they can't work. And they're treated very badly by their families. And so we started pensions. And it's just, we don't have any money for pensions, but it's just savings where after 15 years or 20 years, they can get a pension of their own. So these needs keep coming out. And as the needs come out, our union sevas, we get together, we discuss it, everybody consults, and we start a new organization. I had wanted to talk about, I think my talk was about structural change, but I'm telling you more about experiences. The thing is that a lot of this exploitation and negative or reason why people remain poor, people remain with low incomes, out of formal services. It's a combination of things. Law is important to us, but it's only a tool. Advocacy is important to us, but it's only a tool. Organizing is important because it's the basis. So you, in a way, have to do everything if there is to be any structural change. And for women, especially for women in their economic capacity, I think this is one of the most difficult areas, because in India, women are recognized as mothers. You know, my great mother, very well, mothers are worshipped. Women are recognized as wives, well, not so important, but still. Women are recognized as daughters and so on. But women as victims of violence, you hear all that, but women's contribution to the economy, women as workers, women as self-employed, women as businesswomen, that's almost missing. And so their work becomes invisible. Again, going back to statistics, in India, the official statistics say that less than 25% of women work. Now, this is not actually true, because we have done studies and we find, by the same definitions, more than 60% of women work. And when I say work, I'm not talking about domestic work. I mean their own housework. I'm talking about farming or cattle or making things stitching in their homes for the market. And most of all, in India is still, and so is South Asia, still a very agricultural economy. So there is a very strong feminization of agriculture. Women, small farms, what they call small and marginal farms, which are very, very small farms, are still the norm in India. And farming is still by far the biggest work or biggest employer, but it produces very little. And because it produces little, the men have stopped farming, and it's the women who are farming. So, but when they collect the statistics, all these women farmers who are looking after cattle and sowing and weeding and selling and everything, they are not counted, because they are not workers. And partly it's internalized from them, so when the collector goes there to collect statistics, the women say, they ask the woman, what are you doing? And there she is weeding away, and they ask her foolishly. I mean, they can see she's weeding. She's weeding, and they ask her, what do you do? Oh, I don't do anything. And, then she's written as housewife. So the work of women is very invisible. And because their work is invisible, and as I said, they are the farmers now. But you talk to any policymaker, and the farmer is always a man. And partly because their work is invisible, therefore they don't own assets. So they don't own assets, their work is invisible, and so their economic strength is always very weak. Going back to the farmer example, the farmers are thought of as men. Why? Because that land, that piece of land, is owned by the man. And if it's owned by her husband or her husband's father or three brothers, but no women. Very, 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 very few women actually own land, and therefore they're not counted as the farmer. So to bring change the condition, economic change, economic inequality is, I think, very, very basic. And for women, economic inequality is much worsened. You'll see that they always earn less in almost everything. And I just give you our last example, the last example I wanted to come to, just to show you the kind of things that Seva needs to do. Even more invisible than the farmers, at least you see her out in the fields, sowing or weeding or looking after cattle. But the most invisible are what we call the home-based workers. They didn't even have a name. We had to name them. And home-based workers are those women who work within their own homes. Their home is the workplace. They work within their own homes. They produce something for the market. That could be on a piece rate basis. So, you know, they're giving something by a contractor. They stitch it. They embroider it. They knit it. And then they give it back. And they're paid by the piece rate. Or they could be on their own as part of what is called family labor. So they are weavers or spinning or making food products, and then somebody goes and sells it, somebody from the family. These women don't exist in statistics, very little. And as I said, you know, they don't see themselves as workers. I was just in a house of a woman in Delhi, and there she is inside stitching away, and her husband sitting outside drinking his tea. And since she was inside, we asked, you know, what does your wife do? And he said, oh, she doesn't do anything. She was right there stitching away. And so this, and if we asked her, she would say the same thing. But we, again, you know, bringing out the statistics, we found that in India there are 30 million home-based workers. Worldwide, about 100 million. Things have changed. Earlier, we weren't very globally connected. Now we are very globally connected. So many of these women are actually connected to big retail chains. Chains like Gap and Marks and Spencers and IKEA and Monsoon and, you know, big retail. And they give their work, in India, they bring it to factories and they outsource the work to the factory. And when there's handwork to be done, like embroidery or some kind of filling, then they outsource it to contractors who outsource it to women who do it in their homes. Those women are really exploited because they're invisible. They're not there, really. And so they are paid a tiny, tiny, minuscule amount for what they do. They have no alternatives because they're usually women who do not go out of the house because they either have small children or culturally they're not allowed out. And they're exploited also. The contractor, you know, he may give them the money, he may not give them the money. If they don't continue to work, he'll just go away somewhere. So what do you do in a situation like this? One of the things that, after, you know, many years of work, we actually were in discussion with the big retail chains. And we worked with a organization called the Ethical Trading Initiative to form a code of conduct for home workers or home-based workers. Because what the retail chains wanted to do, they said that, well, look, these are women who work in their homes, sometimes children work, and we do not want to encourage this, and therefore we want to ban all homework, which would immediately disemploy millions of women. So the alternative was to make a code of conduct where they would behave in a certain way so that those women get a certain minimum, that they're not exploited in that their payments are actually made, and that the children do not work with them. So we made this code of conduct, but it was very difficult. And even now, nobody implements it. And again, it's this idea of invisibility, because what the contractors and the factory workers, a factory owner says, oh, well, you know, they're not real workers. They're just women doing something in their leisure time. And when we did a study, we found that they work 8 hours to 9 hours a day doing this in their leisure time. So this, you know, this was part of our rights approach. But actually what we found more useful, or more effective rather useful, is we told the companies, you know, why do you have to go through this whole change? Why can you not give it to the home-based workers directly? And they said, oh, well, we don't know who they are, and they're scattered, and we don't go to the villages. So we said, okay, so we can bring them together, we can form their own company, and you can give the work to their own company. And we are very proud to say that that is what does happen. It's quite difficult dealing with big retail chains, but the women have come together, and they take orders, and now they also have their own shops, and they sell directly. So it's just a mix of strategies. A home-based worker, for her, her home is her workplace. And she needs to improve her home in order to improve her own productivity. But they don't easily get loans to do that, because loans for the home are regarded as unproductive loans. So recently, we have just started a new housing finance company where we brought in bigger shareholders, and about 10,000 women brought in their shares, and we've just started giving loans to women to improve their houses and even to get new houses. And I think when I, just to finish that thought, the homes and the workplace. When we look at urban areas, city planning, urban planning is very neglects, or you know, the invisibility of the informal economy, informal workers, women. It extends really to urban planning, and that is in a way a basis for it. Home-based workers, they practically don't exist, or they don't exist in any urban plan. And so we've had cases in some of the cities where the planners have just declared, well, this is residential and this is commercial, and everybody must stop working in this residential place. And then you have to get together and approach the urban planners and sort of try to get those policies and those laws changed. So when you look at the economy or the city from the point of view of the informal worker, when you look at it from the point of view of the women, you see a very different city. And what we feel we need to do is show that different view of the city to policymakers. By raising our voice, bringing people together, making it a political statement, but also by a lot of research, and also by approaching policies, changing policies, and using the law. This, I was really going to talk about structural inequality in India, but structural inequality today is very much connected to the global forces. When I started 40 years ago, you know, India was India and US was US, and you know, there was no connection. So, I mean, there were connections, but the problems were not connected. At least the problems we faced were not connected. It's not like that today. Today, 5 years ago, the food prices in India just went way up. And that was connected to the international food prices going up. But 70% of India lives near or above the poverty line. You know, we are growing very fast, or we were growing very fast, and we will continue to grow very fast. And so people are better off, much better off. But nevertheless, 70% of people are still at a very vulnerable situation. So when the food prices go up, then there's starvation in many homes. When there was the recession, international recession, we weren't perhaps as badly affected, but we had widespread unemployment. Another, I was talking about the street vendors and the home-based workers and urban planning. We're affected in another way, which is that the mindsets, the concepts of what is a city, a lot of it comes now from not inside, but from outside. So, you know, today, what is a city? A city is Shanghai. Bombay should become Shanghai. And what does it mean for Bombay to become Shanghai? Remove the street vendors, remove people who are slum dwellers, make broad roads, bring in more cars, raise the price of urban land. So make transport expensive. So unless there's an international thinking on how this change or what concepts, what should a city really look like? A city should be clean, but that doesn't mean city should be without people. A city needs street vendors because they provide cheaper food. A city needs housing for everybody, not just for the rich. So those are the concepts that we are trying to develop. And the change must come from the ground, of course. The basic change comes from the organizing and the voice of the women themselves. Actually, I'm proud to be talking to you, but I would have been happy if I had been able, and it was my fault that I wasn't able because I was traveling elsewhere, to bring, we always do that, to bring one of our own members to you and have her speak in her own voice. So bringing the voice of people who are on the ground, organizing the voice so that it translates politically. Today, we have, as I said, 1.8 million members, and that creates its own voice. But we need to link it to global forces. And so one of the things that SEWA has done is try to organize not only locally, but also globally, and form international networks of the same types of workers. So international network of women farmers, of street vendors, of domestic workers. Domestic work has increased a lot recently in India, of home-based workers, of rag pickers, and to make them visible, to amplify their voice. And to also, we have these networks, but we also, as I said, connect with research and policy in order to, the statistics that I was telling you, we use those statistics all the time. We go to a meeting, our women go to a meeting, and they meet the municipal commissioner, and the municipal commissioner says, oh, we don't know how many street vendors there are, there are only a few. And then they rattle off all these statistics. And so, you know, the municipal commission is a little bit more respectful. So we find statistics to be very powerful. And so we like working with researchers. We find other examples to be very powerful. And we like working with people who have been doing things in other countries. As I said, we have been making these international networks. But I do hope that just my being here, some of you will also think about, care about the voices of these women in the informal economy. Remember, there are millions and millions. And to change structures, to change, to bring things more equal, to bring about social justice, it's very necessary to join hands. And Alex told you that I was educated here and there. But most of my members are not educated. So you need people who are educated, people who care, to join hands with people who are in difficult situations who are exploited. And it's only when we all join hands that we can really change things. And so I thank you all for listening, and I hope we have we've communicated. Thank you all. Yes, please.
Of SEWA's 1.8 million members, how many are in rural areas and how many are in cities or larger towns? And is the way you organize them different for rural versus urban?
About 2/3 are rural and 1/3 is urban. And it's changing a little bit because India is urbanizing, but the issues are very different. Because in rural areas, you don't find many employer-employee type of relationships. You mainly have to organize. The most effective way of organizing in rural areas is reaching to the markets, financial inclusion, farmers especially, because their productivity is so low, so forming cooperatives and increasing the productivity. Employment is very low in the rural areas, so changing employment or bringing in new employment. So the two things, whereas in urban areas there's more employment, but there's a lot of exploitation. So there is much more struggle for rights in the urban area than in the rural. Actually, we've seen both sides. So part of the liberalization is the intensifying of the urban areas and the rise in urban land prices and becoming going towards Shanghai. So the urban poor have had more of, there's been a lot of unemployment created there. On the other hand, since we form many organizations. We found, like our bank, earlier the laws were such that they restricted everything you did, whether it was a cooperative which was selling in the market or whether it was lending to the rural poor. You weren't allowed to do many things. Now the laws are much more liberal, so we are allowed to do many more things than we were before. So it's mixed, and it's also like it also has created more employment. Like I was telling you, the big retail chains. So there's a lot of exploitation, but there's also employment. So I think people have got more better off than they were earlier. Yes, please. Most being a trade union, actually our interactions are more through the work we do. So being a trade union, most of our interactions were with the international trade unions. And what we found was that international trade unions are very male dominated. National trade unions are also in India, very male dominated. And so we had a very good alliance with the few women, and now much more, of course, who were there in the international trade unions. A lot of the issues that we were dealing with were very much the same. So the issue of childcare, I think that's one issue that we are very close to the, not only the trade unions, but other Western women's, is childcare, because women, especially I think in all countries, work and have to look after their children. And it's a big struggle and a big strain for them. So, and that's been another negative thing that has happened with liberalization, in that subsidized and government childcare has gone down. And so women have less places, and childcare is no longer considered an important thing for government to support. So that is one issue. Another issue is equal wages. A lot of the successes we've had is in the labor movement now, both in the labor movement as well as in finance. In the labor movement, we've had a lot of successes on getting international conventions at the International Labor Organization. So the first one we got was on home-based workers. And there actually is a convention, which India has not ratified, but there is a convention on home-based workers at the ILO. The next one was on domestic workers. So again, there is an international convention on domestic workers. And that was only possible because our movements in developing countries worked with the women's labor movements, you know, women in the labor unions. Anything specific? Did you have something specific in mind? You know, I tell you something very interesting, which is that in the West, women in the labor force, you have what you call a glass ceiling. We have what we call a sticky floor. It's really called that. I mean, like the glass ceiling. So it means that you can't rise up, because the women can't move out of the floor. But once they move out, then the glass ceiling is not there so much. So you'll find many professional women in many sectors, not all sectors, but many sectors, you find a lot of professional women and women CEOs. But at the place where we work, the women are really stuck at the bottom. So I guess, that is an issue, the whole issue of where are women in the labor force. That's a very important issue for us. But we haven't worked that much on other. The only other one we have worked on is with women in the West is on finance, because there's a lot of exclusion of women from financial institutions almost everywhere. And I know in India, now, of course, it's changed completely. But and it's only changed in the last 10 years. But for a woman to open a bank account was almost impossible. She had to get the permission of her husband, and then she had to prove that she was she. And it's very difficult to prove that she was she because she didn't have an identity. And that's, you know, something that is changing for women. That's something that we have been working on, which is that you have to, women don't think of themselves as a person, but they're also not in the society given a separate identity, because there are very few identity cards. And when she gets married, she changes her name, and sometimes the family changes her first name too. So I think in India, more what has happened now, or what is happening now, the structural change that is happening, is that women are getting their own identity as individuals, which Western women have had for a long time. So, yes, please. In India, beyond a certain age, most, or at least in the, and you must remember when I'm talking about the lower 70%, because the conditions now of the top 20% is much, much different than it was of the lower 70%, and then that it was, say, 20 years ago. So the worst of women are those who are, so most of them after the age of, 20, 21, 22, which has changed. Earlier when I joined, then girls used to be married at 12, 13, puberty, off you go. So now it's 16, 18, 22, like that. So beyond that, most women are married. But the worst, so in a way, the younger girls are having more opportunities than they had before. But the single women are generally those women who have either become widowed or are divorced or their husbands have disappeared. And that also happens. Or, who've gone off and married somebody else. And those women, especially if they're younger, those are the ones in the most difficult situations, especially the widows who have small children, because having small children is difficult for them to work. There are a few special schemes for widows, and they do get some kind of what is called widow pension, but it's very difficult to access. And I guess this is the same thing that widows or single women with small children face almost everywhere. And though we say in India that we give a lot of family support, but actually we don't. Yes, please. Actually, there have been some major changes. This government, and in particular this prime minister, is not very fond of civil society organizations. So there has been a tightening of space for any kind of organization which is not either government or business. Just to give you an example, if you're a civil society organization of any kind, we are a member, what we say, we are not an NGO, we are a member-based organization, but you're a trade union or a cooperative or whatever. So if you want to call an international conference, because we do a lot of international work, you have to get permission from three ministries, and only then will any visas be issued. So you start 7 months before, and you have to give all the passports, names of the people who are going to come 7 months later with their passport details and the passport. But if you're a business, you don't have to take any permission. So the space has shrunk. That's one. The other is that the ideology has also changed. In India, we have many divisions. We have divisions of caste, and we have divisions of religion. And what I didn't mention is that our roots and the union from which we were born was actually what is called a Gandhian institution. In fact, the union itself was founded by Gandhi. And so we believe in the principles of Gandhi, and we've always followed them. And one of the things is that all religions and all castes need to come together. So breaking the barriers of caste, what we call casteism and religion. So Hindus and Muslims working together and thinking of themselves as workers, not as, as stitchers or as farmers, and not as Hindu women or Muslim women. So this government, this thing is changed. This government is much more Hindu fundamentalist than the earlier governments has been. And so those divisions are much more. So that's one difficulty. And of course, in Gujarat, it has been happening for a long time. Those are the negatives. And that ideology is being promoted a lot. So I was saying in the class earlier that, I was saying somewhere, that the language of rights is not appreciated. So rights, environmental concerns, mining, all those things, the rights of people in those areas are not appreciated at all. So it's difficult for organizations like ours, let me put it that way. Please, I'll ask. You know, that was a very major issue, say, 20 years ago. People were not educating the children because there were more hands to work. Also, they were not educating girls because, you know, she's just going to go away to another house and she won't be any use to us. Things have very much changed in India. And most parents, there's still a lot of child labor. Children, especially in the farms or in their own homes. But parents are desperate to educate their children because they see that the economy has changed so completely. So even for the most menial jobs, now people require education. I was reading in the papers, there was a post of what in India is called a peon, which actually means, I don't know how you would say it here. Huh?
A clerk.
Below. Below clerk. Above a cleaner and below a clerk. So, you know, the person who takes the post and so on. So there was this opening for this person. It's called class 4. So opening for a person, and there was a line of 200 PhDs for that post. So the point being that for every post now, you don't really need a PhD, and it's not everywhere. This was just one place. But the point is that most parents realize that for any kind of work, you need some education. So they're really desperate. I know they will curtail all other expenditures to send their children to school. There are some parts of India where people are still not sending children to school because it's expensive. Issue is the schools are not good. Government schools are there everywhere now, but the schools are not very good. And so the children go there and then don't study. Just to finish that point, we work in an area called Madhya Pradesh, which is one of the so-called backward areas. And we find that, you know, earlier children, there's a school within 5 kilometers. So that's two miles or so. And all children were being made to go to the schools, but they were not very good schools. And suddenly in that area in the last 5 years, a lot of so-called private schools have sprung up. And people are saving money to send their children to those private schools. So I think in India, things have changed very much as far as education is concerned. Please. Yeah. Point. Taxation, most of them don't pay taxes direct. They don't pay direct income taxes. But in India, the largest share of taxation comes from indirect taxes, which is still sales tax and value-added taxes. And so that's on every product that they use. So in a way, the poor are paying quite high taxes as a proportion of their income, but not income tax. Also in India, agricultural product agriculture is not taxed. So so that's another thing. And when women earn, do the men take it away? Actually, women tend to put it into a normal, into a pool. Or there are two ways. One is when they actually earn the money. So if you're a street vendor, you're sitting out there, somebody gives you money, so you actually have money. The other is you're a farmer, you produce all this, but who goes to sell it? The husband. So, you know, the money comes to him. So they don't have that much control over money. And that's why having your own bank or having your own bank account, that makes, that's really an empowerment for them. Okay. Seva is in about 15 states, mostly in northern states, so Bihar, UP, Rajasthan, Uttarakhand, even Kashmir we've started. We have only one, Kerala is the only one state where we are in the south. People from here can really help in many different ways. I mean, we can talk about that because there are many different things that we are doing. And what do I see as the challenge? The challenge is, I think, growth. Today in India, it's not just this government, it's been happening for a long time. Bigger businesses are taking over the work, are sort of unemploying small producers. And what we aim to do is bring people together so that they have their own business, because entrepreneurship, what we call group entrepreneurship. So individual entrepreneurs are, you know, for a very small individual entrepreneur, it's not possible today in these markets. So for us, the challenge is that how do you grow these people's businesses? We call it the people sector. How do you grow these people's businesses? And there are internal challenges because they have never worked together as a group. They don't understand enterprise. They only understand family. And then there are external challenges. And your question, taxation is one. What came to my mind, I said, no, I won't say this. In our bank, it's just a blanket. It's not aimed towards a bank. 1/3 of the income of the bank, of the profit of the bank, I'm sorry, 1/3 of the profit of the bank is taken away by taxes, whereas it could be invested to grow. So there is no special policy for what we are calling social enterprises, which have a social cause. And just going back to your question on what can people here do, I think the one thing that we, I don't have something specific, but the one thing that we, most of the organizations we have are try to be sustainable. And we actually have share capital from other people, so from other companies. And but we can only take money from for social enterprises, which means we can't give very high rates of interest. We can give an equal rate of interest that they would get in the bank, but not, you know, much higher. But one thing that we do actually take funds for, or we need funds for, is education. And I don't mean children's education, but people's education. How do you become an entrepreneur? What are your rights for women, especially because they're less educated and less confident, so empowerment. So I think those are the two areas. One is helping to grow of social enterprises and understanding social enterprises, and the other is education of different types. Okay, I think the biggest obstacle is mindsets. mindsets among our own members. You know, like I said, a woman doesn't have her own identity. You get angry, you know. She says she's sitting there working and working and say, what do? I don't do anything. So, you know, that, sorry. So that, so that's one. So her own mindset, the mindset of her family, you know, why are you going to the meeting? What are you going to do there? Who are you going to meet? I just give you one example of that, which is we had formed a cooperative, actually a company of women who do embroidery. And there's this very conservative community in Gujarat in the rural areas who don't like women to go out and everything. And then these women were actually doing it in their own homes, and then they were selling. They were bringing it, or through somebody, they were bringing it to the shop, and it was being sold. And so once what happened was that every year that community would have a big feast, and all the men would come, and then they would, I mean, everybody would come, men, women, and the women were supposed to cook and look after everything, and the men would have their discussions and all. And so that one year, the women got a big order, and they were going to earn a lot from it. And they said, it was Ahir community, and they said, we can't cook this year. And so they didn't. And the community was so, and they made a lot of money that year, but the community was so angry. So they put a ban. They said, no woman can go out of her village. And she cannot go even to the center to collect. And this went on for, it was quite difficult because we had orders. It went on for about a year. And meanwhile, the women were lobbying their men from inside and everything. And then finally, what broke that ban was one of the young girls got a prize for her embroidery. And the prize was in Delhi. And she was to be honored by, I think it was the vice president. And they were going to give, the government was giving two tickets by air for her to come. And the father said, I don't care about the ban. He took the woman, took her, his daughter, and took her to Delhi. And then they told him, you have to pay the fine. He said, I won't pay the fine. And somehow that just broke the ban. But it was a very difficult time because those women were not allowed out. You know, it's very difficult to stay in your home and be forced like that. And also we were losing a lot of orders. So those, that kind of thing. Then the mindset thing is, you know, every organization that we have formed, there's a mindset. When we register trade union, even today, we register in different states. No, you can't form a trade union because you're all women. No, you can't form a trade union because you're all different. Who are you going to bargain with? You don't have an employer. So you can't form a bank because they're all illiterate and they'll run away with the money. So that outside mindset and inside mindset, I think that sort of, I would see that as the major obstacle. Ahirs are in Kutch and Banaskantha mainly, but they're all over. Yeah. Patan. Yes.
What percent of your members are from low-caste
Our members are, what percentage are from upper caste communities? About 5 to 10, maybe 10% are from upper caste communities. The rest are either what in India is called OBC or Dalit. I don't remember what percentage is OBC and what percentage Dalit. I think Dalit would be about 25 to 30% and rest OBC. OBC is other backward castes. That's about the breakup.
So do you face caste discrimination? Like, is it just a group of women members or they segregate by caste?
You face a lot of caste discrimination inside. So, like, for example, you go to a village. And the thing is that our members are lower caste or these castes by trade. I mean, it's because you go for the poor, they are poorer and they are in more manual trades. So, you know, agriculture labor, construction workers. So when you go to the village and say we want to form, we go as a bank and we form a group there in the village. And higher caste people will not allow the Dalit women to come into the house. So then you have to sort of pick up a struggle for that. One of the things that this was many years ago, but even today it is just like that. We started childcare centers, and this was in an area where women were tobacco workers. So this is a special type of tobacco, and there are these big tobacco processing plants, and they would have to go and work there. And they take the small children, and they were going about in the tobacco. So we started childcare centers, and when we started childcare centers, all the children wanted to come, but the higher caste children said we won't put with our, with the lower caste. So then we said, don't come. So they didn't come, but then the childcare center ran very well. So then they started coming and putting the children. But you have to keep pointing it out and, keep doing some actions to change. It's actually a very bad situation. Even now, it's not a very good situation. Yes, please. I actually don't know that. I don't know that because we don't have that much fair trade connections in India. So I really don't know that. So do you think we should? There's actually a law. If you face caste discrimination or somebody speaks to you in a negative way because of your caste, you can actually go and file a police complaint. So I think at the government level, at the legal level, there is a positive discrimination. But at the society level, that's what I was saying about mindsets. It takes generations to change mindsets. I'll end this because we're having an agitation in Gujarat right now. One of the positive discrimination that has happened, and it happened in our constitution, that certain castes had, by constitution, positive discrimination. So in universities, in certain types of government jobs, there was places reserved. Then the other castes who were poorer said that they also needed positive discrimination, and they became more politically powerful. So then there was more seats. And so these were the backward castes, and then a scheduled caste, as they call them. And then there were new castes for whom there's positive discrimination. So they are called the other backward caste. So now the Supreme Court then said you cannot have reservation more than 50%. But then now there is in Gujarat, which is one of the more prosperous states, there's an agitation the other way from the very sort of top castes to say we want positive discrimination, we want reservation, which is a way to try and remove the reservation. So it's the whole caste and reservation and all types of issues connected with caste is one of the turmoils in the Indian scene today. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.